Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,500 archived podcast episodes, visit our website at www.spikeradio.me. Today, my special guest is a returning guest, Linda Yael Schiller, and we're going to be talking about her newest book, Ancestral Dreaming, Heal Generational Wounds Through Dreamwork. Ancestral Dreaming is an illuminating and heartfelt guide. It invites readers to explore the ancestral threads woven through their dreams and to heal inherited intergenerational wounds, thereby transforming pain into wisdom and trauma into blessing, blending trauma studies, dream work, mysticism, and clinical insight. Linda offers an accessible and soul-nourishing path for readers of all backgrounds. Whether practiced individually or in groups, the book's interactive exercises and reflective prompts help readers to deepen their connection to their roots while nurturing the well-being of future generations. Linda is a mind, body, and spiritual psychotherapist, consultant, author, and international teacher. The author of Modern Dreamwork, PTS Dreams, and the workbook Integrated and Embodied Trauma Treatment. She is also trained in EMDR, somatic and expressive therapies, and hypnotherapy. Linda facilitates group dream circles, provides individual, group, and corporate consultations, and trains professionals on working with dreams. Her deep dive into intergenerational healing through dream work is not just an occupation, but a calling. With the depth of an archaeologist, the spirit of a mystic, and the sensitivity of a poet, Linda provides guidance, structure, and hope for all who carry wounds from generations ago. And who does not? For more information, you can visit her website, which is lindayaelschiller.com. And that's Linda, YaelSchiller.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Linda to the show. Good day, Linda.
Hi, thank you so much for that lovely introduction, Robert.
I'm sure that there are a lot of things that we didn't even have in that you have done. Let's start with the idea of how it is that ancestral trauma can be passed on to future generations.
Okay. So there are a few ways that this can happen, and the science, the relatively new science of epigenetics, gives us some insight as to how this is not only an energetic transmission, although it is that too, but an actual physical transmission. So in my research for the book, I learned that the word epigenetic, that epi means above or on top of, and then genetic is the genes. So these are changes that can happen in our actual stem cells, in our genes, that are changed by virtue of what we have gone through in our life, as opposed to what we have directly inherited in the more traditional sense of having a gene for blue eyes or brown eyes or blonde hair or black hair. So when relative of ours, when an ancestor of ours has been through traumatic events in their life, there are a couple of ways that this can potentially get passed on to us. One is their experience creates a hormonal flood in their body with extra cortisol and other fight, flight, or freeze hormonal responses that changes their genetic makeup temporarily. It gets passed on then by the way they parent the children that they have. So, for example, if we had an ancestor who had to flee the Irish potato famine and grew up sort of fear of starvation. And that was sort of ingrained in their system. The way they parented would be fear of not enough, fear of starvation, fear of not having enough food. And they passed these messages on to their kids. So their kids, even though they didn't go through a period of starvation and need to leave their country to find greener pastures, if you will, grew up as if they did. And then they pass this message on in the way they parent their children. So in this way, it gets passed on through environment in from one generation to the next, the trauma of a previous generation. And then going back to the epigenetic layer, what I learned also that is fascinating is that every woman before she's born has inside of her ovaries all the eggs she will ever have. So what that means is that before our mothers were born, we were already inside of their ovaries, which means when they were a fetus inside of their mother, our grandmother, we were actually there too, which is a kind of mind-blowing if you think about it. So at this layer of physiologically being present inside of our ancestors is a piece of this intergenerational transmission, both of trauma and intergenerational trauma, but also of gifts and of blessings. Mm-hmm. And the good news here is that these are not cast in stone. They are not irrevocable. So that they are able to be addressed and changed in future generations when we bring consciousness and healing to this process. We can actually change the way our genetic system responds to these previous traumas, and in doing so, change the way it's held inside of our body and then pass that on to our children and our children's children.
Yeah. Very interesting. Now, you talked about the hormonal flood that happens when an individual experiences some trauma. And you also talked about blessings, but also that strength and wisdom can also be inherited. So what's the physiological spark, so to speak, that would lend strength and wisdom to be passed down?
So if we think about what are our own gifts, right? What are we good at? How are we blessed in our life today? And pretty much you and I who are talking and anyone who might be listening to this podcast probably has a better life today in the world than many, if not most, of the people on this planet. And potentially a more secure life than their ancestors did, particularly if there's a history of trauma in their ancestral life. However, we know that if we can inherit pain and trauma, we can also inherit wisdom, gifts, and blessings. So if we think about a relative that we knew or that we heard stories about, and we say, oh, you know, Grandma, I have a Grandma Molly, so I'll say, my Grandma Molly was such a kind person. So she passed on that ability to be kind to her children, who then passed it on to us. And hopefully I'm passing on that legacy to my daughter as well. And I was actually just talking to someone yesterday who told me about his dad, who was served in World War II in the Pacific War Theater. And it was a horrific, horrific time. And his dad came home with terrible PTSD. So we talked about, you know, that trauma of inheritance. But he also said his dad learned to be really, really resilient in the face of terrible, traumatic, life-threatening events. So that resilience got passed down to the children and the grandchildren as well. So here's an example of sometimes a positive quality from an ancestor or a skill from your ancestor. You had a grandfather who was a great woodworker, for example, and somehow that interest and skill gets passed on from generation to generation, and you got a great woodworking shop in your basement. Or the transformation of trauma into something that allows us to heal and make meaning in our life. In the previous example, the case of transforming this traumatic war experience into an ability to be resilient in life. So those are two ways we can access these gifts and blessings.
Okay, that's great. In your book, you indicate that we are the dreams of our ancestors. How is that?
In generations past, and for ourselves, anyone who's listening, if you have kids or grandkids or nieces and nephews or students or people who you mentor, you have some dream in your heart for how things will work out for them, how they will succeed in their life. And in the same way, our ancestors had a dream for how their children and grandchildren and descendants will survive and hopefully thrive in the world. And we are that dream. So we're, in a sense, the living manifestation of the dream of our ancestors. And here I'm using dream in the metaphorical sense. Mm-hmm. But when we have nighttime nocturnal dreams and have the potential of having dreams about and or visits from our ancestors, then we get to access the connection between what they went through, what they hoped for us, and how we are or aren't manifesting that in our life today to be able to carry on the dream and the blessing that they hoped for us.
And with that idea of an ancestor coming to us in our dreams and, you know, indicating and maybe showing us in the dream some of the gifts that have been passed on, also traumas could be part of the picture. And I believe in your book you indicated that that might come through in the form of nightmares.
That's right. So in the book, the focus of visitation from our ancestors and receiving messages from them, the primary focus is looking at nocturnal dreams. But it also can be connected to any sort of continuum of consciousness associations we have in our waking life as well, what I call dream-adjacent experiences like trance or hypnotherapy or guided meditation. So I delineate six calls that we might be able to get from our ancestors in the book. And I'm answering your question, but I'm going about it from a little bit of a roundabout way, and I'm getting there. So the six calls, the first one is simply our ancestor coming through and saying, I'm still here. I'm not gone yet. And it's letting us know that death is not the end of connection and that they can still be a resource for us in our life. The second call is when our ancestors say, I have a gift or a blessing for you. I have something to give you, something to offer you that from over here on this side of the veil, I have access to give you. Or possibly they have an apology. Maybe there was some kind of misunderstanding or disagreement in waking life and an apology didn't happen. And they want to make sure we know now that we are forgiven or they forgive us or we forgive them. So that would be the second call. The third call from our ancestor could be, you are in need of some kind of aid or assistance or help, meaning us, the dreamer. And from their position now on the other side, as pure spirit, they've got access to information and assistance that we couldn't necessarily access in our own waking life. And they've come to give us help, to give us aid, or to warn us about something to watch out for. So those are the first three.
Okay.
And now the next two look at the question of the nightmares. So I'm going to skip those for a second and just say the very last one, number six, is the request to carry on their name and remember them. Tell your children and your children's children about them and carry on their legacy. So four and five would be the types of dreams that would fall into the potential category of a nightmare. So call number four from our ancestor would be to help them. These are the ones who died in pain, in trauma, in suffering, and did not get to resolve or heal it before they died. And therefore, they're somehow stuck in between worlds and can't quite finish passing over. And their soul or their spirit is still suffering as if they still had a body, or as if they still were experiencing the war trauma or the concentration camp or the starvation or the slavery or the abuse in a home or whatever it was that they suffered in their life. So this call is a request from us to use our resources to send healing back to them, to heal on the other side, so they can finish the journey and transform their pain and transmute their suffering into something that helps them make meaning. And then we get to carry that on. That was one of the biggest messages, I think, from Viktor Frankl's work, Man's Search for Meaning, is that when we suffer trauma or heartbreak or terrible things, when we can make meaning out of what happened and live our lives with a mission to do better and to heal the world, then it's not for naught. There's a reason, if you will, for the suffering we went through. And then the final of the five calls would be the ancestors who are still carrying a grudge match. So some of my ancestors, you know, we have this long history in our family of, like, you know, so-and-so doesn't talk to so-and-so, you know, with the Hatfields and the McCoys, or the Montagues and the Capulets, right, are two famous grudge matches in history and literature. And unfortunately, in those cases, there was more death before it got resolved. But we have the potential here, if we've got an ancestor coming through and saying, hey, you know, I want you to continue this grudge match, and I want you to, you know, be mean to so-and-so or shun so-and-so, we get to say no. We get to say the buck stops here. We get to use boundaries, protection for ourselves, and tell them that we're sending them back to the fullness of the light to be healed, and we're not going to continue the grudge match. So those are the two categories that our ancestors need help in healing, or our ancestors are holding on to old grudges where it might come through in the form of a nightmare rather than the dream.
Okay, good. Boy, those six calls are very interesting.
And the book goes into lots and lots of details about, with examples and how to work with each of these calls and exercises you can do to access the connection and to protect yourself from any inadvertent sort of contamination, if you will, when working with the more challenging messages.
Yeah, okay. That's very good to know, because it can be quite challenging or dicey when it comes to not only interpreting what is received, but also being able to identify the source of the message as being malevolent. I mean, not malevolent, benevolent.
Right. Well, either way, malevolent or benevolent could be either. So, yeah, we need to pay attention to not carry something that's not ours and not pick up something that's not ours.
Yeah. So now, when it comes to being able to distinguish a particular dream as being just kind of a normal dream versus an ancestral dream, and also considering that some of these ancestors, you mentioned in your book, could be grandfather, great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather, grandmother. So, I mean, there would be individuals that one would not have any personal experience with, or even being able to identify. So how can one maybe distinguish what really makes up an ancestral visit?
That's a really, really good question. So first I'll distinguish between a quote-unquote regular dream and a visitation, and then talk about the different types of ancestral connection we might have. So in a regular dream, you might dream about someone who kind of reminds you of your mom or reminds you of your grandmother, or you might literally dream about your dad or your brother or your great-grandfather. But you know it's a dream, and there's not a sense of sort of aliveness of this being a presence happening in the now, the character in the dream. And these are very powerful and important dreams potentially, but they're in the category of dream versus the category of what a lot of people describe as a visit. And many, many people, and there was some research done by the Pew Institute, and if I have the number right, I'm potentially misquoting, but I think they said 63% of the people that they interviewed reported having visits after their loved one died from the other side, and that they knew was a visit because there's this felt sense of presence when you dream about this person, as if they're in the room with you. You can hear the timbre of their voice. You can smell their perfume. One of my clients whose beloved cat died said when she would dream, when her cat would visit her in her sleep, she could feel the weight of her cat sitting on her chest and feel the purring against her heart when the cat visited. Mm-hmm. So there's this aliveness and vividness when there's a visit. I'm sorry, you were going to say something?
No. I've had cases like that, experienced that.
Yeah. So just for example, for myself, after my dad passed, he's the only one in my family who seems to have kind of taken it on as his own personal mission to stay in touch with all of us still alive. And he's like right here, right now, all the time. All I have to do is say his name and he's right here. And I can hear his voice in exactly the way it will sound. And I can see him smiling and kind of beaming, even as I just mentioned him. Now, my mom, on the other hand, she was a great mom. I loved her. But she's really just content to let Bud do his thing with the people in alive. And she's wherever she is hanging out, you know, playing cards or, you know, having a good snack or just relaxing in the afterlife. And so it's different depending on who your relative is, whether they tend to visit or tend not to. And some people say, gee, you know, I really like a visit from a departed relative, but no one's ever come to visit me. So what I've said to them is that some of our ancestors or our family members, you know, have a protocol or a sense of propriety that we may not realize. And any more than you'd show up at somebody's house without an invitation, they might be waiting for an invitation from you. So if you're looking for a visit from someone and you haven't received one, you can start with inviting them. And before you go to sleep at night, do something called dream incubation, where you just spend a few minutes writing down, thinking about, meditating on what you'd like to dream about. And if what you'd like to dream about is to get a visit, invite them. Invite them to come. And you really accelerate the chances and the potential for that to happen in a timely fashion.
And you know, with that, that's really good information for the dream incubation. I recently encountered my partner of 37 years died at the end of July, and came to me in a couple of dreams. Thanks, but also a couple of friends have indicated, you know, visitations as well. And a couple have not had that and kind of felt slighted in a way that they hadn't had one. So I think your comment about extending an invitation is probably where, you know, it differed between the people who have talked to me about having or not having a visitation.
Right. So I think that's one layer, but also we have to be on the lookout for what might be a visit in a surprising or unusual or unexpected way. Because it's not necessarily straightforward where your departed partner shows up and says, "Hi, Robert, so good to see you again. Let me give you a hug." You know, it might not be like that. So just for example, one of the people who was in my dream circle for a long time, her dad died. And she was like, "I want a sign. I want a sign that he's okay. I want to know that he's there, and I need a sign." Nothing, nothing, nothing. Finally, she comes in one week, and she says, "All right, I've had the sign." And she reports to us. Her dad's name was George. And she reports to us that she was driving down the street in one of the boroughs of New York City where she lived, and she turned the corner, and there, as she turned and she looked at the street sign, she realized she was on George Street. And she said, that is definitely my father's sense of humor. And I could almost hear him saying, well, you asked for a sign, didn't you? So here's a free sign.
Literal.
Right. So we have to expand our understanding or sort of like you see what you're looking for. So if we're on the lookout, either in our dream life or our waking life, for connection with a departed relative, we're more likely to find it than if we're not looking for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That kind of goes to the idea of awareness, kind of maybe a heightened awareness of what's going on around us.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, in your book, you indicate that you have a daughter who, an adopted daughter from China. And my question is, now, for some people, being able to identify that ancestral lineage can be difficult, if not impossible. For example, for some, you know, adopted individuals where it was a closed adoption and they have absolutely no information whatsoever. So how does the ancestral trauma or benefit, how does that work with individuals who are adopted and, you know, between their adopted family, you know, they may identify with, but also that biological ancestry that they have no idea about?
Right. That's a really, really good question. And I think from my point of view, it's one of the most important parts of the book. It's not the whole thing, but there's a whole section on how do we understand and work with the whole concept of ancestry when there's adoption. And to the best of my knowledge, that hasn't really been addressed anywhere else before, at least not to this extent. And what I say in the book and what I say to anyone who I'm talking to is that our child has biological ancestors called the birth family. And when they're adopted into a family, that's their family, period. No ifs, ands, or buts, no questions. It's the same connection, love, legacy, potentiality as any other form of making a family. So I always suggest and advise people to really give your child the information that they need about their origins in an age-appropriate way. As they get older and older, you provide more information. But when they're young, as soon as they're able to understand, particularly if it's an interracial adoption, like our daughter was born in China, so there's no question that she wasn't a biological child, so the fact of adoption is right out there. But even if it was a domestic adoption and the kids look like their adopted family, tell them when they're about 3 years old or so, we really wanted to have a family, and we couldn't have a child, and we chose you. And that's probably about enough for a three-year-old. But then as time goes on, you tell them a little bit more and a little bit more about their history, as much as they know, as much as you know, and to be sure to honor both your own family legacy and history and customs and traditions, and as best as you're able to, if you know anything at all about the birth family, honor that too.
Okay.
So just for example, when my daughter was growing up, we called it China Girls Group, and we met with other families who had kids from China, and we met every week for years and years and years, and they got to know each other, they got to know other families like theirs. They learned some Chinese words and some Chinese calligraphy, and we celebrated Chinese New Year, as well as everybody celebrated either Christmas or Hanukkah or Easter or Passover or whatever the holidays of the family they lived in were. And we did both. We did both to honor both sides. So that's something I would suggest to people who have adoption in the family. And to be sure to be clear about it before your kid goes to school. Because if they haven't been told yet, they very likely are going to be faced with questions, A, if they don't look like their parents, but B, somewhere in elementary school, they're going to be given an assignment to make a family tree. And when they go home and they say, we need to make a family tree, there are going to be all sorts of questions that come up that hopefully will not be a surprise to them, as long as you've prepared them in advance, that their family tree might look a little different than some of the other kids in their class.
Yeah, that's really good. And it seems that the more you can prepare your child for that socialization in school, the better, because sometimes kids can be cruel, not necessarily with that intention, but nonetheless,
right,
it comes across.
Yeah. We were really lucky because my mother-in-law was a social worker who actually worked with adoption, a domestic adoption. And she created this thing called life books. So she made like a life book for our daughter. It's really quite a work of art. It sort of shows her whole history, potentiality of history anyway, as much as we knew it in China, and then becoming adopted and coming home and being part of our family. So when my daughter was in second grade and they were doing a unit on family history and family tree, I went into the class with her life book, with her permission, of course, and sort of shared this life book with the class. And it went over, the kids were fascinated. And I had one mom come up to me afterwards and she said, "I can't thank you enough for this because my husband was adopted when he was a baby, but no one ever talked about it, and it was always something that he was a little embarrassed about and didn't know how to deal with. So this was really, really helpful to hear you talking about it so openly, and I'm going to tell my husband about that idea of life books."
Wow,
so you never know where this is going to go.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Now, in your book, you share an ancestral dream that you had, and it was involving borscht. So would you mind kind of just recounting that dream and maybe what your interpretation or meaning?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, that's kind of what the circumstances around that kind of got me started writing this book. So in my dream organization, the IASD, the International Association for the Study of Dreams, I had a colleague from that organization who was in the Ukraine a couple of years ago doing volunteer work, an American who had went over to do volunteer work. And he had my book, PTS Dreams, Dealing with Nightmares from Trauma, with him to help the Ukrainian people deal with their nightmares and trauma. And so I was really honored. And we sort of were communicating, you know, messaging back and forth for, you know, gosh, a couple of years while he was over there. And during that time, I had that borscht dream that you talked about. But the background of the dream is my family history is that my grandfather was born in the Ukraine. And my grandfather and his parents had to flee the pogroms back at the turn of the 19th century from the Ukraine. And then they went first to England and then came over to America. So I felt really honored that it was sort of full circle, that I was now able in some way to help people who were suffering war trauma in the same country that my family had to flee from to avoid being killed. So there was sort of a full circle of healing there for me. And in the context of that, I had this dream. And in the dream, I'm learning how to make borscht. And borscht is an Eastern European, Ukrainian, Russian peasant soup. It's a beet soup. So in the dream, I'm learning how to make borscht. And there's a chef who's teaching me how. And he says, "Oh, first we're going to need a shredder to shred the beets." So we get this shredder and make the borscht. And then I go back to the students that I was trying to teach to make borscht. And they hadn't been able to get it right. So I said, "Well, you know, we didn't have the right equipment, but now we have a shredder, so we have to start over again, and we'll do it from scratch and make it right." So that was the dream. That was the whole dream.
Wow.
So, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that it's interesting how current life events can provide a input to future dreaming.
Right. We know that our daily life is one of the primary source material for our dreams. But we also know, and you asked before about how do we know if there's an ancestor that like we've never met that shows up in our dream. Sometimes in our dreams, there's something in our life, in our environment, that triggers this sort of cell memory or going back and back and back in time. So that our dreams can take us back in time from generation to generation. And we can also have ancestral connection with the land our ancestors lived on, even if we don't live there ourselves anymore. So there's that concept has been known by Native and Indigenous people for a long, long time, that Earth Mother Gaia, she's our ancestor too, whatever sort of spot on Earth we grew up in or where our ancestors grew up, we're somehow connected to in an ancestral way. So that happened at several layers in this dream, exactly what you said. So as I worked with it, my very first sort of aha was, oh, of course, you know, beets, borscht, Ukraine, my book is over there in the Ukraine, and Jose is helping people with, you know, in a country where they eat borscht. But then as I worked with the dream and sort of peeled back, no pun intended, sometimes you peel your beets first, peel back the layers of the dream, I sort of had other associations, and I worked with a friend of mine, because even Carl Jung said, nobody can get to the bottom of their dream all by themselves. It's like trying to see the back of your own head, you know, without two mirrors. So working with someone else or with a group to help you understand the multiple layers of a dream is always very useful. So together with my friend, I realized, so what are some of the associations and the metaphors in this dream? Well, one is that beets are a root. It's a beetroot. That's what it's called. So it's like, oh, beets mm-hmm. are roots. This is about my roots. So the dream was about my roots in the Ukraine. And how do I stay connected with and serve, if you will, or learn how to prepare my history, my rootedness to teach others. So I needed a teacher in the dream. And the piece of machinery we needed was a shredder. So the first thing is, like, you ask, particularly when there's an unusual symbol in your dream, like a shredder, that's kind of weird. What's that? So a shredder is something that, like, chops up your food and makes it digestible and makes it into small pieces so it can be easily eaten. So on one hand, a shredder is something that allows us to digest and metabolize something more easily.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, a shredder shreds. And to be shredded is to be torn apart, is to be in pain. So there's that layer of being shredded as well, of having been forced out of your homeland, of your country, and needing to escape. So with those two layers, I then, in the dream, go back to my students and say, okay, we have to make it properly, and if we use this tool, this shredder, in the right way, we'll turn something that might have been a shredding, heartbreaking experience for us into something we can digest and metabolize and then feed to our children. So that was how I worked with the dream.
Wow, that's great. And, you know, it's wonderful to be able to look at the dream and being able to digest it. Now, in your book, you also indicate that, or suggest, that people should use a dream journal, which, you know, can go toward helping, you know, recall and digest or examine dreams. So now, do you feel that this needs to be a written, something that people can write down, like on paper, or maybe a file on their notes in their phone?
So as a Luddite from previous generations, I have a soft spot for writing things down. So
right.
My first choice for everyone would be to get an actual notebook and use it as a journal by your bed, a dream journal, because the act of transforming something through handwriting allows you to physically use your body in a way that speaking into your phone or even typing into your phone or computer doesn't engage your physical senses as much. So you're apt to get more detail and get the physicality of your dream better if you write. That being said, in this day and age, it's not the only way to capture a dream. So feel free if you want to speak it into your device, but then transcribe it later, or if you are typing, you know, keep it in your notes section. But what I do strongly recommend is that if you want to begin a practice or continue a practice of better remembering your dreams, learning from your dreams, solving problems from your dreams, healing at a physical, emotional, ancestral level from your dreams, you got to remember them. And we all know that a dream is like a puff of smoke. You know, you sit up too fast, it's gone. So getting it anchored down in some way is really critical to be able to get it, be able to work with it again afterwards.
Yeah.
So yes, I recommend a journal.
I've noticed that. I mean, the idea of a dream vanishing quickly upon waking happens to me a lot. So, I mean, I know how important it is that upon waking to take a few minutes and record what I remember of the dream. And that has been invaluable because quite often I'll go back and it's like, oh, yeah, I forgot that detail, you know, and that has some importance.
Right. You're in very, very good company, by the way. That's like super, super common. So what I say to people is that you might be in the shower later or, you know, eating dinner, and all of a sudden you'll remember, oh, I had this dream. Write down whatever you remember then, because you might still capture like the Reader's Digest version. And if you can, when you're still in bed, or if it's early enough where you woke up, you started to go take a shower, and then you go, oh, but I had a dream. If you can, go back to bed for a minute and put your body in the same position you were sleeping in. So if you sleep on your right side and your knees are kind of tucked up, do that. And you will then often recapture what's called positional memory. And your body will remember the dream, but it's put in the position you were in when you had it.
Very interesting.
I've never ceased to amaze how well that works.
Okay, well, I'll have to remember that. I hadn't done that. Now, I've had the sudden memory while taking a shower. It seems like taking a shower is a way for some people to really kind of just zone out or tune in or whatever, but it's amazing the thoughts that can be generated just by taking a shower.
Right. Somehow maybe your body relaxes a little more with the hot water, so it simulates a, not like your sleeping state, but a more relaxed state that's closer to sleep, that allows you to recapture that time space.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're kind of at the close of the show. So what is it that you hope that the readers will take away from reading Ancestral Dreaming?
A great way to went. And one is that, as Diana Fosha, who's a psychologist, says, we are all hardwired for healing. So our system, our bodies, our psyche want to move in the direction of healing. So if we remember that, we can transmute and transform things that were difficult and painful, not only in our own lives, but in the lives of our ancestors, and turn them into something that we can make meaning out of and make a commitment to do some form of healing it forward, whether it's to our children or to our students or to our mentees, and to remember that we can bring that healing into ourselves and into future generations as well. And hopefully to heal the world, tikkun olam.
Absolutely. That's a great way, heal it forward, like pay it forward, but just in
exactly.
A very different way. Well, Linda, I really want to thank you for your time today. I always enjoy speaking with you.
I love
the state, and you always give me something new to think about and enact to be able to make my dreams more memorable.
That's great. Thank you so much. I appreciate your great questions.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my special guest has been Linda Yael Schiller. We've been talking about her new book, Ancestral Dreaming, Heal Generational Wounds Through Dreamwork. And again, you can find out more by visiting her website, which is lindayaelschiller.com. And that's Linda, Y-A-E-L, schiller.com. And in closing, I want to thank you for listening to this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.